Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our regular Monday stream. If you're in Britain, it's a bank holiday, so hey, I hope you're enjoying all the rain.
Yeah, we're getting paid overtime for this stream.
Yeah, we are. We're getting paid overtime by
the
our...
GCHQ wages are doing numbers.
GCHQ are paying us overtime. It's time and a half, guys. It's time and a half. We're going to stretch this one out. It's going to be an 8-hour stream, and we're going to review a Star Wars film. No, it's a bait and switch. Hello, people. I see people filtering in. We'll do our normal stuff as we do. But I know I said that kind of the period of guests was over, but it is not.
We have had this one coming down the pipe work for a little bit. Purely, I think, in some parts, because of course we rather enjoy the company of Mr. Woz, who's
been at
our events and whatnot on in previous streams, and we always have a good chat with. But I just like the idea of a sensible discussion on race. That tickled me somewhat.
Yeah, it's what we'll be doing. But yes, welcome back to the channel, Millennial Awards.
Oh, thank you. It's always fun. I think this is the third stream we've done.
Yes.
Yeah, as well as the conference, obviously.
Yes, with Nomos London, that brings us neatly into a little bit of shilling, I guess.
I suppose, whilst we've got some eager eyes and ears, we'll let people know that we've got our next Nomos event coming up on the 26th and the 27th of May. I'm afraid all the tickets are sold out for the early dinner on the 26th, but there are still well over 30-odd tickets left for the Friday evening. We've recently just announced one of the speakers, Christopher Hansen, who... is not the guy that hunts down pedos, but I'm sure he probably would hunt down pedos.
Yeah, I'm sure he would have given the opportunity.
Yeah. So he's coming along to speak along with some other mystery guest who we have not yet announced.
No, we have not yet announced the other guest.
Probably do it at some point soon.
But we will have Mr. Panama Hat there doing a bit of hosting. There might even be a little bit of poetry from him.
Yes.
I know our poetry stream was wildly popular. But no, it was very good to have you at our London event. This will be our fourth event. Good Lord, when we get a bit of a fixture of ourselves.
Yep.
We previously had them in, the first one was in Manchester. That's why this is Nomos Manchester 2. The second was in Birmingham. And our third with Woz in person, a rare, but enjoyed in person appearance.
Should we try and leave some of our shilling to the end and we'll let
people
fill in here? Well, I just want to clarify before we get into the meat and bones of the discussion. That I don't know if you wish to join me, but I'm going to put my little value-free analysis hat on, and that any statement that comes out of my lips, unless specified over the next 90 minutes, is a value-free analytical assessment of the facts as I see them before me.
Yeah. Is that your version of a disclaimer anyway?
Yeah, I also love the nation of Israel.
We always must start these streams by reconfirming our commitment to the nation of Israel. Yes.
Well, okay. Me too. Then I guess. Yeah, I'll do my best to be objective.
The thing is, ever since we've done that little joke, we have never had a stream demonetized. So
what's your joke? What do you mean?
It's anyway. We'll keep this. I'll keep this on track. If you guys want to find Millennial Woz, if you live under a rock and don't know where he is, you mostly put up your video content on Odyssey these days because YouTube has decided you're a no-no man.
Yes. Well, you were also recently had a discussion with Peter Quinones that went up last night, I think. I'd listened to some of that earlier on today whilst doing bits and bobs around the house. And I think there might be some of the stuff you and him talked about in there that we might also bring up through the course of our discussion in front of us as well.
That's possible. There's always that weird thing about repeating yourself, saying things you've just said. It's different audiences, so it shouldn't matter too much.
Yeah, no,
That was recorded a few days ago now, but he only put it up last night. So, yeah, I've been doing a few live streams.
Fair enough.
You're also back on Twitter. Although, I don't know, Twitter's in a bit of a funny place right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting for me. I'd, you know, it's 4.5 years, and Yeah, I've talked about it extensively, and I'm famous for talking about it. So, yeah, I'll just leave it at that. Yes, I'm there, at least for now, and it's interesting. It's a useful platform to be on.
Well, you've also got, as you talked about off air a little bit, your Substack, which you've been writing for rather consistently. I will
putting
say.
Us to shame.
Yeah, and I've been enjoying the content, despite the kind of up and downs of Twitter deciding and then undeciding that Substack shouldn't exist. They had to row back that pretty quickly, because I'm pretty sure behind the scenes it would have got pretty illegal pretty quickly, because that's a big kind of title, what is it, like Title 2 no-no, whatever they call
it. Oh, yeah,
it
could have been antitrust, yes.
Yeah. So it's a bit of a problem with that. But that drama aside, I have been enjoying your Substack content as well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think I've put up 5 or 6 essays now, and it's definitely developing, and I'm enjoying it. You know, I started it just in February, and it's I've been quite a new lease of life for me. You know, I've never really done it before as millennial woes done in, you know, writing, and it's great. You know, it gives you a chance to finesse things and get them in a nice order. And it's completely different from this kind of thing, you know. It's a completely different type of work, and it's been very interesting and fulfilling to do that. So, yeah, that's really where I'm concentrating my efforts just now, on Substack.
We also have our own Substack. We've been trying to get up regular content on there. We try and have something up a week. Although that's been a little bit kind of spursy at the moment. We have had quite a few ones recently if people want to catch up with any backlog. But generally, if we're firing on all cylinders, we sometimes have Tuesday and Thursday stuff go up there. Although we have been trying to cross-post a bit more as well, just to make sure people see us, because our audience is, as having to exist in so many platforms, can be a bit fragmented. But I think that's enough preamble. We've let people filter in. So it's... I don't know. It's a thorny topic, really.
Yes,
and one that I've seen much fraughtness about.
Well, it's something as well that in conversations we've had with other people and things we've discussed in streams elsewhere, and also probably more clear, I would say, in bits of writing we've done. People ask us, you know, well, where is your position on it, or you know, do you see it in this way or that way, or are you ethno-nationalist or are you not? And it's like, well, we, through a lot of the stuff I think I could fairly say I've predominantly read over the last few years, have taken ourselves into a very sometimes pre and or anti-modern view of things.
Yes.
And from that you begin to understand, I mean, one of the ones that I think almost kind of prompted doing this stream a little bit was when I was reading some of the neo-Tory stuff, describing sort of British conservatism during 1929 to 1939. And in the middle of that period, in the middle of the 30s, there's this massive nationwide discussion on the topic of eugenics. And that would instantly tell you, if you were a somewhat apt reader, that the notion of race and the reality of it were complete and utter givens to these people. And that was the only reason why something like eugenics was even worth discussing. Because they had already imbued themselves, you know, throughout however many generations previous, with the view that them being English was, or English or Scottish or British or however we want to describe it, was unique, and unique in a way that could be realised both in sort of cultural products and then, you know, them physically existing in the space. And we will attempt to not use too many sort of roundabout ways to talk about it, because we're by no means scared ourselves, but I think that the language of actually having to deal with some of this stuff is very undeveloped, because quite frankly it comes from a subset of ideas that, as I've said already, would be complete givens to people beforehand.
Yeah, it's like
it's amazing how much of a break there is, you know, historically, with 1939. Because, as you say, prior to that, eugenics. I mean, eugenics is now a sort of nightmare word. It's one of the most verboten terms. You know, it's supposed to be hideous, but really, it was all through the Anglosphere in the first third, first, in fact, more 40% of the 20th century. It was just a given that, of course, you know, not only are we a race, but we are, we want to refine and improve the race and cleanse the race and even purify the race. I mean, it's stuff that is never attributed solely to the mid-century Germans, when really, you know, both sides were just as guilty of it, so to speak.
Yes.
Because it's kind of common sense. I mean, you want the best for your people. And it's quite amazing how this has happened.
Well, it was a very fashionable idea in most of the world throughout the kind of 1900, as you said, till kind of the 1940s, really. And even a little bit afterwards, there's some great stuff of the Soviet Union messing up their weird experiments. Like, the Soviet Union spent like 20, 30 years trying to clone, make and breed Scythian warriors, basically. And they were obsessed with that. That's one of the areas of history that's long been forgotten. But it's not to get too off track with the eugenic stuff, but the kind of the starting points I'm going to go from here are race, culture and nationality are immutably intertwined.
Before we get to the next point, which is the connection to this, because it's how you understand national identity properly, just think for a moment about how many people in our sphere or in some of the spheres we have been in online.
Yeah.
That when you say race, culture, and nationality are immutably intertwined, would be like, that's postmodernist guff. You know, they would come out with some sort of reaction to what they're saying as if, well, that obviously can't be true. One, because they're saying it, and two, because they're the evil, mean, racist leftists.
I realise I've made a spelling mistake here because I had to remake it. Yes, college. It's supposed to say knowledge. I just pretend we're all Cheem's dogs and we don't speak proper. That should be knowledge. I actually accidentally deleted this slide and had to quickly remake it just before the stream. So do ignore the... I said college before it was cool, yes. But that is supposed to say knowledge. Do ignore my occasional typos.
No, I just thought it was important to point out that many people will off the bat reject what is the pre-modern view of race and ethnicity under the guise that it's some sort of new postmodern French academic fabrication of something that is completely non-existent. Whereas here you've got, you know, clearly ethnos was the understanding of race well before we have ever had any idea of something like genetics or genes or DNA or the sort of material sciences. It was something that wasn't just known, but to a certain extent felt.
Here we go.
Well, you know, there's common sense though, isn't it? I mean, it's perhaps less so now, but certainly when I was a kid, you could, what's that, 30 years ago, you could actually see different phenotypes by travelling around Britain.
Mm.
There was something slightly different about people from the north of England. There was something slightly different again about people from the south of England. And I dare say if I'd travelled more, I would have seen more varieties. And then with, you know, Scotland as well. So if it's a felt reality, it's not something that you need to analyse, and that's just within the British Isles. So obviously, I mean, you can see when if there was a kid at school who was, his mother was Polish, then that kid would look slightly different. And it's just a thing that's self-evident. So, I mean, yeah, you don't need the science of genetics in order to see this. Now, obviously, they had different names for it, bloodlines and kinds and things like that. But it's ultimately, obviously, it's the same thing we're talking about.
Yeah, I've got up the North FC face because they're, as you learnt from moving here, especially like the northwest of England, like Lancashire and Yorkshire, people do look different.
Oh, aye.
They are noticeably slightly smaller. They all look like bin men, basically. The North FC mean people who have not been here, people who have not been in the Northwest. That is not a meme. That is just how people look.
I mean, that was something I was well aware of, even, you know, like in primary school as a very young child, like growing up in Glasgow, because you'd have folk that would be like Huns, and you'd have folk that are Tagues, and the Tague folk are the ginger ones, where, you know, they tend to have either brown or green eyes as opposed to sort of darker blue. They've not got straight dark hair that's lighter, more curly. You know, these very small differences, which are, you know, differences from hundreds of years of different interbreeding between different mixtures of Irish, Celts, Anglos, Normans in my case.
You
end up with these sort of different admixtures, I believe might be the phrase. And it's so, as you go on to say there, it's so obvious that these differences exist before us. And the fact
actually, just one more example of that. There was a program in the 90s called Biker Grove, and about a year ago, I got curious about it, so I googled it. Biter Grove. Yeah, and it's obviously set in Newcastle, and I was looking at images of it, and it struck me how it was. They look like kids from Edinburgh, and it's obviously Newcastle. And then, of course, there is this, you know, old time link between those areas. You know, Northumbria stretched up as far as Edinburgh, etc. And you realise, okay, so this is. I mean, they don't look like kids from. Well, obviously, they don't look like kids from London today. But even kids from London then, it was quite amazing when I saw that, because I thought that this could easily be, people that I grew up with. And actually, there was another thing just related to this. I heard a bunch of recordings of World War One soldiers that were recorded by the Germans, actually, POWs, and. There were linguistic similarities between the Newcastle accent at that time, 100 years ago, and the Edinburgh accent. They said "feyther" instead of "father." But I didn't even know that. I've never heard someone from Newcastle say that. But again, it's an interesting. It shows you that there was traffic between these two parts, which are now obviously divided by a border. But there are types. And phenotypes around the British Isles, yeah.
Thank you for the donation, Coney. You're reminding us that we are somehow still monetized. If you want to link us directly, the best option we still have for that is our PayPal, because Streamlabs has decided that it doesn't want to work anymore. But we do still have YouTube monetization, so if you guys want to ask us questions, send us stuff, that is the easiest way, and the way it takes the least cut is just via PayPal. I have the thing up on my phone anyway. I'll be able to grab if there's any of those. Just a very, very quick reminder and quick show to people. But thank you for the donation there, Coney Current Year. I've always liked that username. But you are correct. If you go into some areas of Northumberland, you will still hear that.
Mm.
It's very interesting. Even it's one of the things that's supposed to kind of debunk, as it were, the English as a race. But the static nature of many of the communities that have, as we've learned through genetic data now, I don't want to get in too empiricoid with it, as it were. We're trying to have more of a philosophical discussion about it. But there's been a lot of very static genetic material in Britain, even regionally, for the last 700, 800 years in many cases. And if you were to go back to the 1950s even, pre-motorways, someone from Northumbria would be measurably genetically distinct than somebody from, say, Plymouth or Cornwall, or, you know, especially places like the Hebrides and places like that. And that, I think, rather reinforces the idea of these permanent, static, distinct, and, you know, very real and defined communities rather than weakening.
Well, yeah, I think maybe this could be the opportunity where we work in, and something that I always come back to at the moment, which is sort of, shall we say, a more defined understanding of culture. That in this view, you know, it's not just that race and culture are intertwined by happenstance. It is that a specific race, a specific people group in a specific land, with a specific, you know, faith or set of rituals or practices, whatever it is they do that sort of keeps them all together, they produce a culture. And that is only really under those situations, other than a very small number of exceptions, that anything that we could recognise, not just culture, but as high culture, can actually be produced. I mean, it's something I've mentioned a number of times now in stream, and I want to really drive home, is that I think we should stop even using the term multiculturalism. I think there is only ever the multi-ethnic jungle, which is the negation of culture as we should understand it.
Yeah, if your land doesn't have a shared culture, it's not a land. It's a mess.
It's just a rock.
But the starting point, again, ethnos exists outside of the legal fictions of the modern world, which is just a roundabout way of saying that people have been people before we had ways of recording that they were people.
Yes.
Knowledge, and I put the N there, nestling. A phrase predates modern concept of genetics, and like I said, in pre-1945, we can haggle about that a bit. These were taken as given, but I just wanted to kind of get those out of the way. If that's not quite where you are, this might not be a discussion for you. And like you said, the first point makes a lot of people very uncomfortable, but I don't think you can have a discussion about race without that part being settled. Otherwise, you are discussing like sociology in the abstract. You are not yet discussing race.
Well, there's something as well to be said for the kind of the myth of the post-racial society.
Mm.
It has never really existed to any great extent, because if you go and talk to anyone in the local pubs about the issues of the day, their issue with Muslims isn't their state of dress, you know, per se, or the food they eat per se. It is all the other characteristics that come along with the fact that they are from a different race.
I see AA there with four
exclamation marks. It's an entire thing, isn't it? It's
yes.
They're simply a different people. And it's annoying when, you know, you'll get liberals who try to break it down and they say, okay, well, what are your objections? And then you have to pinpoint some particular thing. And then they say, well, that doesn't really matter, does it? Or... Well, actually, you do that. Your people have that thing as well. They have their own version of it. So, really, there's not a great big difference. But there is a great big difference.
Yes.
And it's just, when you try to break it down, obviously it falls apart. But that's like the breaking of a spell. It doesn't negate the fact that the spell was real in the first place.
Yeah, and it allows for a sort of one-way kind of linguistic trick as well. Because you know, someone like, you know, that we think of Der Tony.
Yeah.
When he stands up and he makes some sort of point about immigration, other than some of the radicals under his own party who we never really hear from anyway now that Corbyn's been shut up, no one's challenging him with saying, oh, well, the thing you're saying about immigration is inherently to do with race and ethnicity and so on and so forth. It is just assumed. And the gamins accept the fact that when he's talking about immigration, he's talking about immigration of people of a non-British race outwards.
Yeah.
Or at least that is the ideal. But then if you were to try and, you know, do the opposite there and not be the people in power, but discuss immigration and not make the clarifications about race that you're required to in the liberal framing because you're not in power, you're not allowed to do that. So this is something that they both police but can also take advantage of.
It's a good... Well, the thing that I'm thinking of currently is the fact that the Keir Starmer and people like that definitely do understand that there is still residual British and English and Scottish and Welsh and all of the different old countries of Britain, as it were. There's still solidarity within them, racial solidarity. And he is kind of going around at the moment essentially framing himself as implicitly as the great white hope. And it's, as much as I hate the Labour Party, what they are doing at the moment is actually politically genius, because they're able to, because Starmer's able to posit himself in contrast to Hamza and in contrast to Rishi Sunak. And they've been, you know, people are already shouting about dog whistles, but really what they're doing is they're allowing themselves to a little pinch of the acknowledgement of the truth that they know, one, that racial difference is real, and two, that racial solidarity will never go away. And it's interesting to see those assumptions baked into most of what the regime does.
Yeah, I haven't kept up with this. I mean, my understanding, I mean, this is a tangent, so be careful, but my understanding is that Keir Starmer is operating under the guidance of Tony Blair. And Tony Blair was always very pragmatic and not ideological, like, for, you know, obviously Jeremy Corbyn. He's such a good example of a guy who just talks to the ether. And ideologically, you know, whereas I think, and that was a danger for Labour because it makes them seem, you know, distant and airy fairy. But Starmer, it's dangerous because it's so insidious. You know, it's a deception and it will fool people. And then of course it will just be massive amounts of immigration as usual.
Well, I'm sure it's something you've definitely noticed, Wells. But if you talk to the man on the street, you know, the imaginary man on the street, as it were. But if you talk to the people in the pubs, they understand a lot of this stuff quite implicitly, especially if they've not been to university.
Well, yeah, I mean, university is obviously the thing where people go there to unlearn stuff that. And maybe it was always that way, but in our age, it's so toxic because they unlearn very useful common sense things, and then that is replaced with ideological drivel. But yeah, I think that people do implicitly understand all of this stuff. It's just obvious. I mean, again, if you I remember once asking a liberal. I showed him one of my last liberal friends. I don't have any now, and I was talking to him about mass immigration, and I simply showed him a photo of a particular area of London called Southall, which is, I mean, virtually entirely non-white, by which I mean obviously non-English, non-native. Again, you can look at photos of this area from 100 years ago, and it's unbelievable. Just, you know, it's idyllic, actually. Anyway, I showed him this photo of it now, just crowds of brown people. And I said, do you think you could ever belong there? And he took ages to answer, and then finally he wrote, possibly. That is just total delusion. There is no way that he could ever belong there. I know it, and he knows it too. But he has to delude himself. He has to, because otherwise he's going to face up to something very. It's going to shake up his worldview. The point I was making there was that you can just see it. You know, there is no. You don't need to analyze or anatomize, you know, what is the difference exactly. You know, it's everything, as you were saying earlier, the culture, the genetics, history. I mean, this is why immigrants to Germany are not expected to feel any guilt about the Holocaust, because everyone knows, just to bring another controversial topic in, because everyone knows that they are not of that people, they're not of that group. They don't have that history, so they don't have to answer for it and atone for it. Then, of course, there is simultaneously the delusion that they're just as German as anyone else. It's absurd.
Well, yeah, thinking on the subject of sort of universities and people being taught to, as I think as A put in chat, unlearn basic elements of what was given common sense for centuries.
Yes.
I think that from a sort of more bird's eye view, you can see that what they're doing is putting people through 4, 5, you know, 7 year long struggle sessions so that they can actually produce research that does acknowledge race, but only from a certain very carefully constructed place. And doing this over and over and over and over again, the whole project of, you know, empirical studies about grievance issues or X, Y, or Z ethnic studies have really just been a long-winded way of studying the failures of black people.
It's that there is a lot of material generated by what would be considered the, I guess now, the illiberal establishment. There's a lot of controversy about this, because what seems to happen is that people talk about, well, that's, they're the neo-segregate. It's very, it gets very Democrats to the real racist very quickly. But as I put on the little slide here, that the existence of inherent and immutable racial differences is baked into progressive narratives about racial equity. They're simply doing it from a different direction. Oh, we not lost you there, Woz.
Sorry, yeah, I wasn't. I didn't have the video up on screen, so I was just going to see it
Fair enough, fair enough.
to catch up with what you were saying. Could you explain that for me? Because I'm not sure what you're saying here.
I'm saying that a lot of the the positive discrimination stuff, the equity rather than equality, the massive permanent resources that are given to these groups to give them a permanent leg up, that the assumption that's baked into that is that without that they cannot compete. And so really, if you look at it, especially the people at the top who are not ideologically
Sorry. I get. I know what it is now. And then the naive Republican will say, "I don't believe that they need a leg up. I believe that we're all equal, and it's racist to say that they. It's the racism of low expectations."
Yes, the bigotry of low expectations. It's funny because the progressive left are, in effect, racial realists. They just reach a different conclusion.
That's what I meant, that they spend however many years as at university going through all the legwork to construct a view of race that allows them to engage with it, but they're not seeing it, they're not conscious of it in the way that you would if you just walked from, 1920s London into 2020s London.
Yes, it seems that the idea of striving for a post-racial society and all the rhetoric of liberalism is only picked up still by a handful of people, and they are basically bullied into it by an establishment that does not believe what they are saying. And they are also bullied from the other end by a huge group of people who are incensed by the denial of reality. And that there seems to be this extremely shrinking, small place in the middle for liberals. The liberals have basically become like the God of the Gaps people. Their little island of equality, not equity, is shrinking. And it's quite funny to see people like James Lindsay and those type of people not know how to deal with the fact that they've become an anachronism.
Yeah, it's the old boy. I found an opportunity to stick myself in the middle and be a pain in the arse to two groups of people at once.
Everyone's mad at me. I must be right.
But at the same time, if you were to say to the left, well, why do certain races need a helping hand? They wouldn't say it's obviously because they're inherently different and less intelligent or whatever. They'd say it's because of structural violence and systemic oppression. So even they can't, I mean, they're not racists in the sense that we tend to mean or whatever.
Well, they're
It's all about
racialists, I think
society
it
for
might be
them.
the term. They
So, sorry?
are racialists. The point is not so much that they always speak to the differences, but they very much recognize that there are different races. As much as these people will, out of one side of their mouth, they will speak, at painful length about how we are all one underneath the skin and we're just the brotherhood of
Excuse me, it's
man.
one race,
At the
the
same
human race.
time,
Yeah, imagine all the people. But at the same time, at the other side of the
at the
mouth,
same time
it's
they'll talk about lived experience and or organic
historical
history.
grievances or,
Yeah,
imperial injustices.
stuff that is very real. It's just not genetic.
Watch them go to the lengths, I reckon, in short future of actually trying to explain away the IQ gaps and populations in Africa and India with stuff like climate change and pollution. That watch keep your eyes peeled for that one.
One of the other kind of elucidations of the way that the current regime acknowledges and weaponizes both race and the idea of homelands. It's not what you think. It's actually the way that they talk about the Kurdish people. If you look at some of the coverage of Kurdistan and the Kurds as a racial group, as they're supposed to feel sorry for, it is very much almost a blood and soil invocation of the brave Kurdish race defending the racial Kurdish land. As quite amazing when you read some of this stuff.
Well, what about Ukraine now?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, Ukraine is a similar thing. Tibet in the 90s, not anymore, obviously, and especially not with the Dalai Lama. Well, yeah, let's not get into that. But yeah, blood and soil is, and then of course the Native Americans within America itself.
Yes.
The blood and soil is something that, far from being outrageous, is easily accepted by liberals and, well, progressives, as long as it's not our blood and our soil.
Well, to quote, I wrote an article that I've been trying to shill to people for ages, a little bit of a difficult read, called The Holy Mountain, about the kind of the concept of both the sacred and the sacred within like a racial sense in some ways, that people don't have, like, people's land is sacred to them, and it's something that is very real to a great amount of people. It's very real if you're Kurdish. It's very real if you're Israeli. It's very, or they're trying to make it more real if you're Ukrainian. It's something that they must acknowledge and utilize. And yeah, the defense of their home.
And it is sacred. You know, it's a weird thing is when I moved, when I lived away from Britain, I've said this many times, but it's relevant to this topic, because when I lived away, I thought that I expected that I would miss the British people, but what I missed more was the landscape. You know, the actual place.
Mm.
That was far more of a thing for me. Because it's just not the same. You know, Germany, just where I was mostly, just isn't, it's just not the same land. It's not my home. And it's amazing how much that becomes a thing once you're away.
Yeah, I can't remember. I don't think I've told this aside on stream before, so I may as well, because I think it's quite funny and relates very much to the point you're making here. But, you know, very selective allowance for people to engage in positive identification with a blood and soil kind of narrative. And when I was away at Mises U last year, and I was talking to some of the people, there was a lot of these people who were, quite frankly, like, terrible autistic libertarians that are what I would have been, you know, a number of years ago, where you find some ideological frame and you think, right, let's just go take this as like a hammer to everything. Mm. And then you realise to some extent that doesn't really work. But that's aside the story. At one point I'm sitting discussing with some of the people, you know, about, you know, economics, culture, basically try to get them to a point where they're trying to recognise some of the elements that play into culture that you wouldn't just read from Mises. Or at least not straight away anyway. And one of the people that we were having a conversation with was this sort of woman who was like, well, you know, 1/8 or 1/4 like Native American. So I start to say, well, you know, these things like blood and soil and ethnicity, you know, and there's these Americans standing around who are like, you know, shocked at the idea that this is what a nation, this is what makes a nation. And then I flipped the whole thing in its head and appealed to the Native American woman. She'd be like, well, she's knows what I'm talking about. And all these sort of woke, or not woke, but American libertarian folk that have had to give airs probably to woke stuff day in, day out throughout their entire lives were entirely put on the back foot because I just made some sort of like really strong argument for them into that kind of stuff.
Time and again, it's the centrist who just doesn't get it, just doesn't understand. And they have their own theory for this. They'll say horseshoe theory, which means that basically the far left and the far right end up meeting and they're just the same. There is the same crazy collectivist mentality. First of all, there are fundamental differences between the far left and the far right. But also, I really think the centrists should look at themselves and realise that they are the outsider here. They are the odd ones out, for whom a reality that is obvious to everyone else is just invisible. It's like they're the you could say, colourblind, the autistic ones who just don't get it. There's something that's obvious to everyone else. And they pride themselves on not getting it. Like, that's a sign of their intellectual and moral superiority. I mean, this kind of stuff is just... it's just infuriating. For me, you know, I've spent years battling the naivety of these people. And ultimately, it is naivety more than anything. And, you know, intellectual hubris, I guess, as well.
The big problem I've seen, and where a lot of this comes from, is the framing of the nation of immigrants by America. As I always keep saying to people, and it's a point that I always, always get a lot of shit for, that we basically must regard America as like the great Satan. We must look at America in the same way like the Islamic world does in certain ways. That they are going to stretch out throughout the world and destroy every single culture that is not kind of whatever form America takes in the current moment.
Well, this is sort of something actually I had thought about, because from the conversation you had with Pete, I believe you've discussed the nation of immigrants sort of narrative a little bit as well, and some of the other things about, like, well, do you see America as a nation as the product of immigration or a nation as the product of imperialism? And it's probably a bit of both. So you could almost kind of look at it as like the maybe some of the problems that happen with America are because they're trying to control like the Roman Anglo Empire from like the farthest flung like wildland regions of it, as opposed to the center of Europe where it came from.
I also find as well, and I write about it in this essay, is the fact that I struggle with the framework of like globalized white identity, because that's not something I bet in fact. That is a globalization and a simplification to me.
Yes.
If you look at the way that things are written about pre-1900, they talk about the English people, or even as granular as the Flemish people, the Bavarian, you know, making jokes about how the Bavarian is different to the Northern German and things like that. People have a very, very linked view of ethnos. They know that people from a place are a certain way, and that is almost infinitely divisible, but not in a way that makes it meaningless. It means that there are very particular groups of people that are very easily recognizable from the way they speak, the way they dress. And there's that great kind of just absurdity that if you reduce down the civic nationalist framework, they literally do believe that if in, say, 1900, you genocided all the British people and replaced them with sub-Saharan Africans, that you would still get like the modern British state.
But they go
You'd
Anglican,
still have the Beatles.
They go to Anglican church and drink tea. What do you mean the difference is?
It's a very controversial thing to say, obviously, now, but it's of a certain people in a certain time, in a certain place. And without those elements, these things do not happen.
Mm.
And it's always the way I think about liberalism. And that another thing that people do not like is when you tell them that liberalism, when it was devised, it's for high trust, static society, white people.
Yeah, so
specifically Northern Europeans.
Well, is it John Locke, this sort of liberal bastion of morality and humanism? He took quite a few years, if not the best part of a decade, to really come round to the idea that black people should be emancipated. And he's the arch liberal. He's the tabula rasa blank slate man, but. The whole...
Didn't he write a defense of slavery as well?
Well, that's what I was going to say. I think he originally went from a defense position to changing his mind on it for a number of reasons. And that's why you end up with like Thomas Carlyle being one of the last few people around who's willing to speak honestly about it. And he goes on to say something along the lines of, you know, you can in law ban slavery, but you will never, you know, legally rewrite the relationship that has to exist between white people and brown people insofar as that one is going to have to serve the other.
I always think about the fact that having not lived in a country with a history of thousands of years that essentially Americans and Canadians and all of those people who think of themselves as a nation of immigrants have almost like a form of psychic and metaphysical damage in which they do not understand the link between the land, its people, its culture, and then the outcomes.
Well, yeah, it's as if there is, you could almost suggest that there is like some secret organ of the body that makes use of the feeling of belonging, and that by being in some sort of multi-ethnic jungle, that you don't get to exercise that ability. and that you probably just completely lose the sense to even maybe recognize what it is, which might be why they are these kind of people who just, you know, as you said earlier on, was that you show your mate this picture, this bit of London that's like completely full of black people, and he's like, well, could you get along there? He's like, well, maybe I could. Maybe that's because he is so genuinely lost in that sense that he couldn't understand why he wouldn't.
Well, I mean, he was an English guy, which makes it even more tragic. But yeah, I think you're right that that mentality has been imported from America over here. I do think you're correct that
big N.
The big N is back. We had a slight OBS crash there, but we're back now. We're back.
Well, yeah, was sort of, I don't know exactly where we cut off, but you were making a point about how, to some extent, in the earlier period in America, that they probably had
You can see it. Yeah, you can see. I think they had a more defined culture and a more sure, confident sense of themselves than they do today. So my only theory here is that World War II, as much as it was an accession into superpower status for them, it also really detached them from their history. And you can say that's not entirely organic process, sure, but I think mass capitalism, corporatism, all of this would have played a part. But I think fundamentally there was even a conscious drive to merge, like all of the ethnicities in America. You know, I think there was a conscious drive to merge them together linguistically as well, to enforce the use of English, and then to replace all of it with a sort of prototype globalist culture. I think America was the first globalist nation. Much as, and you can say a similar thing about Britain being the seat of the empire. Let's not get into that. But the point is that I think America was the first globalist nation, and then that was exported to back to the old world.
Well, yeah, I was going to say...
So that you then have that mentality of just, like, there is no connection between a people and a land. Well, there was in America just 100 years ago.
Well, no, that's what I was going to say, though, is I actually think that the more explicit view of the American patriot, to be the ultimate cynic, I'm going to say that that's probably the consequence of them actually coping about not having the other elements that makes you a nation. That they had to have the flag-waving, you know, boorish attitude, because the sort of subtle high culture that existed in Europe prior to that really couldn't find its footing there in the way that it had here. And we've got this lovely little bit from Cunard Leyden, and people who were happened to be at the Nomos event in London will maybe recognise this little bit. And I think he makes a very salient point here. Culture is personal and something rooted. Civilization, on the other hand, is international, interchangeable, and ambulant. There could be no melting pot, no Americanization on the basis of a new synthesis of Slovakian peasant dress, Sicilian songs, and Swedish folk dances. Only the jalopy, overalls, the ice cream soda, and the corner drugstore could serve as common denominators. American society at large had to make its change from the emphasis on culture to the acclimation of depersonalized, collective, and common civilization, which is why we end up with this, you know, Evolian view of America as symbolized by mass consumption, and ultimately something that is, maybe the phrase you could use is a negrified characteristic.
Yes.
That there's this association with big, bold, brash, it's got to be loud, it's got to be noisy and colourful. This is what we recognise as American.
There was someone, was it de Tocqueville? Someone said this, made the point that American manners are clearly influenced by the black population in America because they're, you know, very... extrovert and bombastic and loud. I wish I could remember who it was who said it, because it was so long ago, and it was rather amusing. But I mean, I don't want to bash Americans. I know that there's an American guy in the live chat who I think is a bit offended by what we're saying, and look, I don't think that any of us have any particular beef with America as such, and certainly not Americans. It's just we're just trying to make sense of things here.
I'd, There's a big difference as well. People can't seem to understand the difference between, you know, the ground level America and American hegemony. As I will repeat, American global hegemony is the great Satan. It is what spreads the disease. That's the whole point of the, you know, AA seems to be chomping at the bit to talk about that. He said I could, you know, talk up for 5 hours about the American disease, because there's people, again, they need to delineate the problem from everything else. And really the ultra politicization of the very basic concept that people are of a race and of a place is, you know, the fallen aspect, really, of kind of the mid-century narrative. As many of us, you know, are mid-century revisionists, I would argue that the nationalism of the mid-century is due to a failure state after the Industrial Revolution, and having all of these people essentially ripped from their traditional professions and their traditional places, and attempting to create these national level identities, when for hundreds and thousands of years, really, most people primarily had local identities, and they had local ideas, and they knew their neighbors, and they identified themselves as from an identifiable place first that was around them, and then with the nation state.
Yeah, and this is an interesting aspect of it, that you realize how different life was prior to the Industrial Revolution, and people moving to the towns and then having to, kind of weird, you could almost say multicultural, but it's not quite. It's more like multi-locational or something.
Multi-regional, really, yeah.
Multi-regional, yeah, where they're meeting people who have also arrived in the town from, you know, 50 miles away from the, in the other direction. And that's someone they would never have met, like, a generation earlier. They would almost certainly never have met that person in their entire life, and now here they are working in a factory alongside them. That must have been very strange.
I actually think...
Again, it serves as a template for future stuff. Sorry to interrupt.
I was going to say, I think that's maybe one of the few situations where you could actually say something like multiculturalism did exist. You would have had people who would have moved into the cities earlier on, been sort of first movers, would have become more kind of cosmopolitan and technicized or industrialized as we would recognize it now. And you would have people who would have
just in the most basic way, not so much cosmopolitan, but just detached from the local and the rural.
Yes.
That would now seem laughable to them. Mm. Oh, you've got some festival in that town. Haha, that could have been me if my parents hadn't moved here. But it's all alien to me because I live in the big city. I live in this big industrial town, but which, 50 years ago was just one street, but now it's a big bustling town. And for them, it would seem kind of laughable and quaint to have a local folk festival.
It's interesting as well how... even when there are such similarities, there is still differences. You have a rural-urban split. I mean, one of the ways I think about it that really goes to show, you know, not to always point out the hypocrisies of the double standards, but if I was to run around calling myself English, people would be like, no, you're not, you're Scottish. But if someone who is of mixed ethnicity and then sort of festoons themselves in sort of a biscuit tin style of patriotism, runs around and calls himself English, everyone's like, oh yeah, go ahead. So what is it about me?
Oh, yeah.
You know, is it that Scottish identity and English identity are so mutually exclusive in a way that African and English identity aren't?
It really is just the brain cancer, really. It's the absurdity of it that people can't seem to reconcile. And that it leads people who are supposed to know better, I think, to say rather silly things.
No, I'll have you know, Enoch Powell was a Sevenat.
it all gets very magic soil very quickly, but only for certain people. Again, if I was to go around saying I was Japanese, people would first of all think it was some kind of disgusting weeaboo, but they'd also just think it was ridiculous.
Mm.
It's like you're very obviously not Japanese.
But that's what I'm saying, even in the situations where there is such similarity,
yeah.
You know, me as someone from the west of Scotland and you as someone who's from the north of England, you know, we are genetically probably very, very similar in a lot of ways. But, you know, for you to come up and say you're Glaswegian all of a sudden,
oh, yeah. Like, what if I run around, you know, certain pubs in Liverpool professing the fact that I was a born and bred Scouser, I'd get very glassed very quickly.
But again, the inverse, though, as soon as someone who's, you know, some English Muslim, or, you know, that we have these fake half identities that then just become defaulted into English in some sort of strange way.
Yeah, like, we're having some issues.
People were peeking under the curtain there a second.
Yeah. we will be reading a few. In fact, I should probably do that now. Just read a couple of the donations that have come in. Thank you again, Kony Current Year, for saying, I believe that in between German race autism and Brazilian ethnic cocktail mixing, there is a sensible position on race. Probably a sensible position on race, probably a ratio of 7-1. When we're not playing build your own country, but I'm sure the Brazilians have been trying that. Because there's the whole thing about the Brazilians, like, low level trying to eugenics themselves into being white,
yes.
Which is quite funny. Jux Interior, thank you for the £5. Lab has learnt from Labour has learned from the Conservatives that you can be in power whilst doing none of the things you said you would, hence the pre-election tough talk. I'd say that's just all electoral politics, really. That's just the nature of all democracy, that really you just don't have to do anything as long as you're in power, and the people in power don't actually change anyway. And thank you for becoming a member, Promethean Healing. We do have memberships, and that's probably one of the best ways to support us. But yeah, it's ridiculous for me to say I'm from a different town. I'm obviously not.
I just see AA talking about. I remember going around Glasgow once with a local bird who said she'd protect me. Back up 110.
On that thing about how, you know, English people will say that a black guy is English, but you and I aren't. And obviously we're not English, but that's a fact.
Thank God.
But yeah, but the ridiculous thing is that the black guy is. And I really think the answer to that is simply guilt. You know, they know damn well that he's very different from them. They know they're supposed to not see that and not think that. And the way they'll do it is to say, well, he grew up in England. So there we go. That means he is English.
Yeah. And this is
that really doesn't negate the biological facts of the matter.
No, and it's something I've a point I've brought up in discussion with people before, which I think makes them really rethink how not lost our situation as natives to this land is. That really the most deracinated people in Britain aren't necessarily the Brits. It's probably young, first, second, third generation African migrants.
I was going to make a point about this. And I know we're trying to avoid mentioning Calvin Robbins specifically, but he's a good example. If you have someone like that, who is bread and butter, flag waving, love my queen, you know, a tub-thumping black British Windrush generation, you know, Jamaica cake and street parties, and they have children, those children very often become the kind of people who change their names, wear traditional dress, and try and get some semblance of identity that is from their ethnic background rather than their, civic background, as it were. And there's a huge pattern if you look at terrorism in Britain as well of that.
Well, and that was going to be
It's really interesting because if you look at the photos of the Empire Windrush passengers disembarking, they're wearing, you know, waistcoats and tweed jackets. And you think, you know, their grandchildren are now, you know, raving and ranting about how racist England is and how they're not English and so on. Well, these people coming off the boat were clearly trying to be English. And I think the sad story there is that it obviously just didn't work. It just didn't take. At any rate, they had a sort of mission to come here and, you know, integrate. Whereas and that would have kept them busy, as it were. You know, that's a sort of a goal. Whereas their grandchildren don't have that mission. They don't have that goal. They're just trying to deal with what they've been born into. And what they've been born into is deracination.
It's one thing that I always find incredibly upsetting about the liberal framework of immigration. The idea of assimilation and integration being possible is that you are, one, expecting people to do something that is impossible, and two, even if it was possible, they would have to effectively abandon who they are and who their ancestors were in order to belong here. And I don't think that a British passport really is worth destroying effectively the ethnos of who you are.
Well, I think as well that the further point about sort of there is no multiculturalism, there is only the monoculture or the negation of culture. That the, you know, they can't come over here and set up the temples and it, you know, this, that, and the next thing and expect everything to work as it did from wherever land they're bringing these traditions, because the traditions are of the people on the land. And I think almost to a certain extent, the element of exclusivity makes the culture what it is. The fact that you then have to, as someone who is English or Scottish, you know, walking down the main street, you now have to experience the alien in your own culture, which directly changes the nature of it entirely. And they of course have the inverse. They're trying to supplant, you know, all these sort of elements of their culture onto our land and amongst our sort of communities. And of course, you know, there's going to be tensions from that. But I just think in a, you know, even from an abstract, there'd be no way you could really see that working if it requires the exclusive people, place and faith.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think they are suffering and they are deracinated, and they don't fit in, and they know it. They feel it, and they blame that on us being racist. But I think that's a cope. On well, I mean, you know, most British people are bending over backwards to not be racist and to welcome these people and to not talk down to them, to not even refer to their different skin colour. So I don't think it's racism that makes them feel out of place. I think it's being out of place that makes them feel out of place. Mm. And it's just a fact. And the only way that that can... I mean, there are only two ways that that can be resolved. One is that we all just become so mixed, all of us, that they are no longer out of place. Or they return to their ancestral homeland. And the danger is that they mix so that their kids wouldn't fit into that homeland either.
That is the other part of it, that you get a lot of people who are born in Britain, who are from different places, who try and go back there, and they basically get chased out of town because they don't recognise them as their people.
Yeah, it's basically a lose-lose.
You end up as someone from nowhere. And as the liberal framework collapses in on itself visibly, and as all of these structures that were built, and all these promises that were made to these people go unfulfilled and fall down, the more that they realise that there is just no going back.
Oh no, I'm imagining all these kind of like 1/8, 1/16 black girls that will go to like some fancy uni in Britain and study like politics,
yeah, they'll go to African studies.
I'm going to go back to Sudan where my grandparents came from, and they're just going to get like
they're going to get mowed down with an AK. There's always that danger of the naive class of people. As you've noticed, you can pick out people in Britain who are of a Nordic background or even a Norman background, and a lot of the time their genetic material has been in this country for hundreds of years, and even then they have not fully integrated. It's a very, very slow process. And when we talk about the, you know, when the historians trying to lie to you talk about all of the, you know, the Celts and the Angles and, oh, well, we're all from nowhere. These are people who moved over hundreds of years, some of them over thousands of years. And these are people who were then static for hundreds of years and thousands of years, as is always the case. From modern to pre-modern, the time horizons are vastly different and vastly bigger compared to the really 60 years of kind of racial, multiracial politics that we've had in Britain. And as is the thumbnail, the Empire Wind, which is the thumbnail for this video, prior to that boat arriving, there really was no racial arbitration that went on at a low level, at a personal level in Britain. It didn't happen. It wasn't part of people's lives and conversations because they were quite simply all British and they understood that implicitly. And it's such a difficult thing for us to understand from our modern perspective. But this conversation only makes sense once you have effectively destroyed the nation. The racial arbitration has to come after the mass immigration. And that never happens with the permission of the populace. And it is something that people, especially who are still plugged into the liberal framework, just butt up against because it's something they don't really have an answer to. They don't have an answer to how a nation goes from a homogenous nation to a non-homogenous nation with a large amount of strife without the, you know, the permission of the masses, without the magic of democracy happening, because nobody really votes to destroy their own country.
No, and of course it's not just a genetic destruction. It's all of the other stuff as well. It's the stories, the ancestry, the heritage, the sense of place, the attachment to place. I mean, you just can't fake that. You can't. Some Indian immigrant who was born here, he still doesn't have any of that furniture, which otherwise he would have been born, as a native Briton, he would have been born into. He would just have had it. I think that it really has been a huge lie to both sides, to us, but also to the people coming over. I mean, and in retrospect, you can see why it really is ridiculous. The idea that you could just transplant people and all of these ancestral links just wouldn't matter. Why wouldn't they matter? And as we said earlier, the need for them reemerges after the initial excitement of moving in the first generation. The second generation are a bit more, they don't have that, but they're also just born into it, so they're dealing with it. And then I think it's the third generation where they realize how the paucity of identity that they feel. They realize the loss of the absence of something tangible and real, and then they rebel against it. Of course, part of this is all culturally influenced as well. You know, I mean, 40 years ago, no one was really encouraging them to feel resentment and so on, whereas now they are definitely very, very much being encouraged to feel that. So we can't. It's difficult to separate the intrinsic feelings that arise from the process of integration and the loss of and the failure of integration, and the stuff that is inculcated by the media, the feeling of resentment.
There's a plane full of doctors.
Well, that's the other part of it, is that their ongoing failure to integrate. I mean, I'm even speaking about the higher IQ, peoples who are, not from the Congo or something. People who, in theory, should be able to integrate just fine.
Yeah, it's also a game for those in chat to spot which person in here is Panama Hat.
No.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
But yeah, in theory, they should be able to integrate just fine, and yet, I mean, I remember talking to a young guy, and he was moaning about his he was an Indian. He born here, brought up here, but both his parents were Indian, and he was moaning about, he'd done a sociology degree, and he was moaning about how racist it was, the teaching of a sociology degree at a British university in the 2010s, and he was saying it was racist because they had this white imperialist presumptions. But who's told him that? It's them. It's the lecturers themselves who have implanted that idea in his head, I think. Maybe not, though. Maybe not. Maybe that actually emerged from him. I don't know.
It's interesting because I had a conversation with someone who was from India when I actually went to go and see Ed Dutton speak. I did a little quick thing about Nomos thing, because I was actually promoting the Birmingham event at that point, partially why I was there. But he's somebody who is one of the people who divides his time between the two places. And he had a very kind of first-hand take about that he feels quite aggrieved by the fact that he doesn't feel like he belongs anywhere. Because he was taken to basically his ancestral homeland and to see his ancestral shrines. And he said that was great and everything. But like he works and lives in Britain. He goes to India when he can, but he doesn't feel the connection with his ancestors that, you know, they felt with the land. But he basically just said, like, I realized I won't belong in Britain because, like, my shrines aren't here. My ancestors aren't buried here. Like, in a spiritual sense, this land will never be sacred to me, no matter how hard I try, and it makes me really sad. And that's such, I think, such a powerful framing and something we forget, that there is really the sacred aspect of the, you know, the land and the race and the people and the ritual and all of that stuff, as we like to talk about. We've talked about a lot of the kind of the metaphysics of sex on this channel when we talked about Eros, but there's a lot of kind of the metaphysics and the sacred aspect of race and being a people, and that is completely not only absent, but it is forbidden in the modern world. It is seen as, especially if you are like a white person in quotes, or a British person, or whatever kind of Western nation you're from, if you're not part of one of the designated native groups, having a spiritual and metaphysical connection to both the idea of your race and your ancestors is seen as you being like an actual Nazi, no matter what you believe or who you are or how you identify with it. That is seen as one of the strongest hallmarks of effectively being evil.
Yeah, I mean, you're supposed to be nothing but a consumer. You're supposed to really just live in the present and define yourself by whatever you happen to be doing today, this week, whatever clothes you happen to be wearing etc. I wonder if the same will eventually be, the same expectation will eventually be made of non-whites, or if they will always be, because they're just now privileged, you could say. It's understood that they're going to have cultural ties to the ancestral country. And so the demand is not made that they just see themselves as consumers. That's specifically for us. But I wonder if eventually the program will advance and they'll be expected to just see themselves in the same way as we are now.
Possibly. It might get to a point. Things might get to a point where it's so extreme that somebody who isn't mixed race, who can identify themselves as nationality, is put upon by kind of what we would now consider as the white people rules. That if you identify yourself with a nation state and with a people, you are dangerous and you don't fit in with, you know, the global state. You are not part of the Great Beige Horizon, as that weird CBC race mixing rap they put out said about the fact that they're going to breed people into a homogenous beige mass with no culture and no history.
Well, that's it's Clement Attlee in 1946. You know, if we blend all the races of the world, there will be no more wars.
Yeah, it's one of the things that there's quite a high bar.
God.
Yeah, he did actually say that.
Pretty much word for word.
Yes. I think there's a pretty high bar, though, for being English, as it were. We're going to do a follow-on stream at some point. Sorry to not include you in this, Wells, but we're probably just going to do one called, like, Who Are the English? As a bit of a nod, let's be fair. But just to go over some of this stuff in a little bit more of a structured way and talk about, you know, what actually makes the English, and have a pretty basic answer to that question, as some people seem incapable of doing. But it's not only genetics. You can have someone who is genetically English, but doesn't identify with England because they haven't been raised here. and you know they have been raised overseas, or they don't know the culture and they don't know the history. And you have to have those two elements. There's the idea that as long as you're culturally, in quotes, British, that's good enough. But really, you need to be both. You need to be both, you know, passively of the land and actively engaging with it, or else you lose who you are. And that's, I think that's the big lie that most people are told. Like, English is something you are, but it is also something you do.
Well, I don't know if we maybe want to go back to my speech from Nomos London, the quote right at the bottom, a little bit from Francis Parker Yockey, because if you're going to have a view of race and people want something to go and read on this to get to kind of where we are, a lot of the stuff he has to write in Imperium about race, for someone who you are told is this like loony, you know, frothing at the mouth, Nazi, anti-Semite, this, that, and the next thing, he's actually a very reasonable man. And his view of race is like one that's ultimately sort of subjective. He's like, well, you know, the nation of immigrants or the linguistic group or any sort of, you know, objective standard to either reinforce or destroy sort of nationhood is, it's all sort of irrespective. It matters not because it is there and we live as if it exists and we continue to do so. And the only certain people, and he goes on to use this phrase, men of race, are those that truly both embody and sort of exemplify the nationhood itself. Men of race are scattered through all populations everywhere, through all races, peoples, nations. In each unit, they make up the warriors, the leaders of action, the creators in the sphere of politics and war. Thus, in the subjective sense, there is also a hierarchy of race. Above the men of race, below those without race. The first are swept up into action and events by the great cosmic rhythm of motion. The second are passed over by history. The first are the materials of high history. The second have outlasted every culture. And when the stillness resumes its sway over the landscape after that whirlwind of events, they are the great mass. And I've got a little bit of ad here just talking about how, for what we might even dare to refer to as Big C culture, this idea of culture being one with both race and faith and the land, should be the bedrock of all we do, for this view is a synthesis of civic, ethnic and religious patriotism, which looks far beyond today's ochlocracy into the past and the future for elites that can produce and protect what is most important to us. And that's the, I think, one of the things as well that separates us from the more traditional ethno-nationalist view, which is that there is some sort of, you know, equality, but only for whites, or the welfare state, but only for whites, which is a view I can be sympathetic to some degree. But the philosophy behind that, that doesn't then have a hierarchy, you know, outside of races and within the races themselves, I think is misplaced. And that if you really want to get into, you know, not necessarily, I don't know, you brought up the horseshoe earlier, but one of the things that really sets out the understanding of race within the right-wing view as opposed to the left-wing view is that the hierarchy isn't just between them, but also within.
Yes. You're almost getting into the great men of the place and the time of yes. the race kind of thing as well there. But
oh, absolutely. You know, I was doing research early this year in January about my hometown and Edinburgh, which is 20 miles away from it. And this really came through. It was like 100 years ago. And it really came through that there was a sense of the people, not just as a sort of, you know, blob, a mass of people, but a sense of hierarchy, and so which provides structure. It provides creates from what would otherwise be disparate atoms. It creates a structure, and then that is something that can cope with the world and interact with the world. Now, that's not to negate the individual in any way. It's just to say that, practically speaking, I think this is what a healthy people is. It's a collective creature, and you know, it has abilities and tendencies and so on. But fundamentally, it has hierarchy, because without that, you're just it's just a mess. I mean, it's the whole thing about the organised minority versus the disorganised majority. It's a similar principle, really. You can either have function and structure and hierarchy, or you can have just disastrous equality everywhere. You know, I think within a people there needs to be this. Otherwise, it's not really a people. You know, the denizens at each level, that can be constantly in a sort of tussle. I'm sure it is, but nonetheless, that tussle needs to be going on, because otherwise, as I say, I just think that egalitarianism is a complete nightmare. It's just the destruction of meaning everywhere.
Absolutely seconded, as is the sort of any liberal notion towards pluralism. Any sort of sense that you must make what is being English or Scottish or Irish or Welsh inclusive to everyone else. And that moment that it becomes inclusive to everyone else, it has been destroyed. It no longer exists.
Yeah, when it's basically when everyone's Welsh, no one is.
Exactly. I couldn't say it better myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've got a few more minutes left here. We tend to try and do kind of a tight 90 minutes, including bits of shilling and stuff. So is there anything, I know we've talked quite a lot here, is there anything you wanted to add or say, or anything you felt we've missed here, Millennial Worlds?
Well, Academic Agent has been in the chat, and you know, he said earlier that he doesn't feel he belongs anywhere. So I thought it would be nice to say that regardless of everything we've been saying in this, I think Academic Agent does have a home, at least among us, and that I don't think anyone thinks any less of him for being half Welsh.
No, he is welcome amongst friends.
It's something we've talked about, and a lot of people struggle with in terms of yourself or other people. The idea of the individual versus the abstract and the mass, and the idea that things that are bad in aggregate are not necessarily something that you should
have instantly reject.
Yeah.
Yes.
Have as verboten in terms of the individual. And we're not saying, and we would never say really, that like mixed race people have no right to exist and they have no right to belong. What we're saying is the simple immutable fact is that because of the way that racial difference works and racial identity works and how immutable it is and how they can't kill it no matter how hard they try, they will struggle the most.
Mm.
A lot of people, again, we talked about it on our stream about Evola, kind of descriptive versus prescriptive.
Yes.
This is not what we're saying the world should be. We're not trying to reshape the liberal world into one in which there is this, you know, rigid racial hierarchy and everyone's a racist. We're pointing out the fact that this has always existed and always will exist. One of the biggest points I keep trying to make to people is that the fundamental issue with not just a liberal framework, but with modern politics in general, is that there is not an ability to reconcile with reality. And as we always try and put forward in these streams, that the idea that like man is born free, in a sense, is one of the great falsehoods.
Nor is he inherently good.
No. And that this isn't people, this isn't us or anyone else trying to say that man should not be good and that he should stop being good. We are simply attempting to describe reality. That's why we call this a sensible discussion on race. And I think that's the biggest barrier.
Yeah, the biggest barrier is the requirement to think certain things and pretend to feel certain things. I think that honesty is really the key, the first step in all of this. And what I said there, obviously I'm joking about Academic Agent. It honestly doesn't bother me. It doesn't really occur to me. But it is something that he obviously feels. And I think that acknowledging something is half of dealing with it. And the problem for most people who are mixed race is that they don't acknowledge it. They don't acknowledge that they feel out of place. And I think once they do, they would probably feel a lot... It's easier to deal with. The other thing in all of this is the matter of quantities is essential. I don't think anyone cares about a small number of people. The danger is widespread genetic change, and all of the cultural deracination that would come with that.
It's not just a matter of genetic change, really. It's as we talked about, it's a matter of the fact that you end up as a people without a place. You end up as essentially a destroyed nation. You end up as a destroyed people, and that the people exist apart from the nation. If Britain was declared, you know, non-existent tomorrow, if they did actually just go out and make the global government and say that all nations no longer existed, the British, the English, you know, the Scottish, they would not stop existing. They would still exist apart from that.
Yeah, if they took our passports, we would still be what we say we are.
But would that be true for America? It's a hard one to say, because there are so many conflicting racial and interest groups through that being somewhat of an unnatural nation, that do Americans still exist without America? Because, you know, in racially homogenous countries, like the Japanese still exist without, you know, if they declared Japan was over tomorrow, you couldn't declare that the Japanese as a people were over tomorrow, because they have such a long history and they're such a homogenous society still. But there's also a long history of, well, of displaced racial groups, of peoples without a country. Both of those examples completely just blow a hole in any sense of civic nationalism, because civic nationalism doesn't account for peoples without a country or countries without a people. Neither of those things can work in that framework, but I'm pointing out the hypocrisy again. Is there anything you'd like to shill before we take off?
Oh, just my Substack. I've got my website, millennialwoes.com. There's obviously the Twitter, the Telegram, my beloved Telegram. and now my increasingly beloved Substack.
and to make a slight reference to that Telegram, I believe you've got through this entire stream without using the word incredibly.
I was conscious of it, but I did use amazing several times early on, so I was looking out for that as well.
You need to get your thesaurus.
He's got his thesaurus out. Yeah, he's got a word a day calendar going.
I must have been using that word quite a lot in the Pete Canoni stream. I don't know. I'm not sure what Stevie was referring to, but apparently I did use it a lot. So there we go. My apologies if it has been in any way monotonous.
Yeah, so whilst we've got a large number of eyes and ears, we will once again make mention of our Nomos event that we'll be doing at the end of May. I'm glad the people in chat are showing appreciation from the stream amongst the very hard-to-please academic agent himself. But, you know, please do consider buying a ticket and coming out to the event in Manchester. There is a community both on Discord and Telegram to help you organise travel or accommodation or anything else you might want to do on that weekend. I shall say the Friday, if you want to make a whole weekend of it, there will probably be a basket weaving thing on at the same time.
Yes, I will also shill. You'll be able to find people who know about this, but if you do buy a ticket or if you do want to come to the Nomos event, it's a good way to connect with the UK basket weavers.
It is.
They're a little bit cagey sometimes about advertising because of, you know, entryism, and they want to gatekeep as much as they can, really, but that are, you know, low-key, there are local kind of institutions of people who you can just go and you can just have real-life friends, which...
The friends are out there.
Yeah.
In a sort of X-Files-style manner. But yes, please do consider coming along to our event. Tickets are for sale, and I believe the link is both in the description and has probably been pasted in the chat a number of times throughout the stream.
Yes, it has. I'll paste it once again. Since thank you for all your ones, and thank you everyone who donated. Thank you to all our members. Thank you to Millennial Woes for coming on stream. Thank you very much.
And if you want to find more of us doing stuff like this, consider subscribing and following us and reading the Substack. Because actually, secretly, we're this based all the time. We just don't make it seem so.
we try and hide it by being a little bit more academic and boring. But you can really be this based in a sensible way, guys. You can. You can just talk about race.
You've got to be based in a sensible manner.
Yes, you do.
So yes, do thank you, Millennial Wars, for being so sensible with us this evening.
I've done my best.
Anyway.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me on.
And good night from me.
Good night.
Aha, they keep saying we're talking at the end of the streams. It doesn't quite end, but I am.